I have a list now embedded in this data of all of these women, these contemporary women in all genres of music who are signed. So when people say, you know, when festival promoters or event promoters say, we don't have women in our lineup because there just aren't any, or we can't find them, or we've asked them all. When I hear that, I can just say, no, you haven't asked them all, because here are thousands over here, and you can just have a look and, you know, go book them.
Welcome to Series 3 of Greater Than 11%, a podcast whose aim is to educate, inspire, and demystify creative careers, all the meanwhile promoting some awesome women and non-binary folk. For episode 92, we are joined by the founder of V Bain Consultancy and the creator of the F List, Vic Bain. Vic has worked in the music industry for 25 plus years and set up her own company in 2019, and around this time began compiling the F List from research she'd been undertaking, analysing the gender of who was on the rosters of over 300 UK record labels and publishing companies. Her findings were published in the report Counting the Music Industry and demonstrated, with data, how few women are supported financially by the music industry in comparison to men. For the stats, at that time, only 14% of writers signed to publishing companies were women, and only a meager 20% of female artists signed to labels. In 2020, just prior to the UK entering the first lockdown, Vic decided to share the Google sheet she had been compiling of female talent in response to the online discussions about the Leeds and Reading festivals lineups. And well, in short, the F List blew up the internet, as Vic had over 3,500 names of UK female performers in that spreadsheet. So that old adage, wheeled out time and time again, that there are no female musicians and performers, was dead in the water. In 2017, Vic was inducted onto the Roll of Honour at the Music Week Women's in Music Awards. And she's also been included in the BBC Radio 4's Women's Hour Music Industry Power List. She's also a director of the Board of Incorporated Society of Musicians and is a trustee of the Parents and Carers in Performing Arts, also known as PIPA. She continues to advocate for change within the music industry and is currently undertaking a PhD at Queen Mary's, focusing on equality and diversity within the music industry. Vic, I feel legendary falls short of how best to summarise all you've done and do. Welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you so much.
So, where to start? You have so many strands in your career at this point in time. It'd be great, first off, to hear a little more about V Bain Consultancy and its purpose and why you set it up.
So that is my business consultancy, really. And I probably spend about half the week focused on that. That's how I earn money, which supports everything else that I do. So V Bain Consultancy, I primarily focus on helping organisations, mainly music, but sometimes the wider creative industries, and help them with all sorts of equality, diversity and inclusion work. Sometimes that is doing research reports, sometimes that is training, sometimes it's EDI strategy. So it's all very interesting. All my clients are very different. I really enjoy it.
That's amazing. And I wonder if we can also then talk about some of your other roles, because you, like you said, you do a lot of research, you're a campaigner, and I'm interested in how this all came about and how that led you to currently working on your PhD.
I think my whole 20 odd years working in the music industry, or mainly in the music industry, it really led me to this point. It couldn't have led me any other way. Working in a very male dominated industry, which became apparent from the moment when I graduated and I moved to London in 1997. I worked in a chain of secondhand record stores, and I was one of about 120 staff, and six of us were women. So at that point I realized, oh, this is a very male dominated industry. And since 2005, I've been involved with music membership organisations. So at that point, I started working for the British Academy of Songwriters and Composers, now rebranded as the Ivers Academy, because we also ran the Novello Awards. And again, that was very male dominated. No more than 20% of the membership were women. And I was there for 13 years, and really all of my experiences there of working in sometimes all male boards and turning up to events with songwriters and publishers, it was just, you know, it was just obvious. You just look around you and go, where are all the women? So when I eventually became chief executive at Basker, I really made diversity one of our campaigning issues, and I really pushed that forward. So when I decided to leave and set up on my own, I wanted to make that my full-time focus, because that had become my passion.
That's so interesting, isn't it? As well, like from the get-go, even just working in a retail environment and it also being really skewed in terms of gender, that's fascinating. I'm wondering if you can maybe give us a little bit more of that narrative and that history about kind of, you know, we went to university and what you studied, and then kind of a little bit of an overview of kind of where you've ended up today. Because like you said, you've obviously had loads of experience and you're a chief executive officer of, you know, a music industry, you know, known body. So I'd love to hear more about how you arrived, you know, up to there and beyond.
I think my whole career has been facilitated and enabled by education. And that's something I feel very, very passionate about. So my background is I was actually born in the northeast of England, in a, you know, the wrong side of the tracks in Gateshead. So, you know, very poor working class background. None of my family have gone to university or have a degree, apart from my brother, who just very recently got a business degree facilitated by his work. But I come from a huge family. My dad's the eldest of seven. I have maybe 25 cousins on that side alone. And working in the arts is just not something that we did. You know, I had to really fight my dad. In fact, I had to leave home to go into the arts. We had moved around and I moved back to the Northeast when I was 19, because I knew I wanted to go to university and I wanted to be in a familiar area that was cheap, because I was totally financially supporting myself. So actually I did a BTEC in performing arts at Gateshead College. I then did a higher national diploma in classical music at Newcastle College. And then I was the very first year that what became the stage at Gateshead College, I did a performing arts with music degree there. So I was the very first year. So technically I never went to university, but it was the only way that I could manage it with the knowledge that I had at the time. And it was good enough. I had got my certificate. That's what I needed. As soon as I had that, I moved to London.
I heard you kind of mention that you had to fight your father to go and study further. Did you also come from a musical family, though? Was that the drive, or you were just like, this is what I need to do, and you went off and did it?
No, I mean, nobody played anything. I mean, at my grandmother's house, I was there a lot while my parents worked, and I had, you know, aunts and uncles who were older than me. So they were teenagers as I was growing up, and they always had the radio on. So I was very imbued with lots of radio, lots of record playing. So I discovered, you know, a love of popular music. There was no music in my immediate family, but I did start going to sing in church choirs. And that was something that I did again on my own. We moved to Bicester and I sang in the high church choir there for many years. And that gave me some classical training, you know, which was very useful later on when I was having singing lessons and doing my grades and so on. But yeah, no artistic. I mean, my mother, all, you know, often says to me, I don't know where you came from.
Love that. So when you kind of went through this process, was your focus on becoming a musician / performer? Was that the kind of aim? And if it was, you know, you've obviously sidestepped and gone a different route, more down the business route. I mean, what was the switch with that?
Yes, and I think I did want to be, you know, either an actor or performer, musician. When I was in my teen years and early 20s, actually it was during my BA degree years that I realized that I was very good at the business side of things as well. I was always directing the shows that we put on. I ended up president of the student union. So, you know, so I was always taking charge, taking control. It's just good at enabling other people in a non-dictatorial manner. That was sort of my leadership style. I was very collaborative. And I just instinctively felt that was something that I was good at. So even when I was doing my degree, I was interested in doing maybe an arts management master's or something, but I couldn't get the funding at the time. When I moved to London, and I had, you know, in Newcastle, I had been working with a professional musician and releasing, you know, professional recordings and so on. So that was something that I wanted to do as well. But when I moved to London, I had no money and I had to pay rent. And doing, you know, doing a bit of experimental music, which was kind of the area I'd moved into, was not going to pay London rent. So I had to very quickly decide, yes, I'm going to work in the business side because I can make a living out of this easier. And if I do any creative music making or performing, it would just have to be the icing on the cake.
That's amazing. I love that journey. I also love that your mum is like, I don't know where you came from. That's so sweet. I think, you know, you talking about, you know, having this drive to do something creative, but then realizing that you have really great collaborative leadership and actually that also can pay the bills. And, you know, it's something that can give you a sense of satisfaction of being involved and supporting others, which is a lovely way to the F list. So I would love to talk about kind of what your thinking was around that. Obviously, you've talked about working with organizations and looking around and not seeing many women, but kind of how that you started putting that together and why you were thinking about putting that together. And I do want to stress, and I know from previous conversations, like it was a total labor of love, right? You were doing that all in your own time. And I think it's really important to stress that, because these things that have become amazing resources often are people taking the kind of initiation and the time to do it. So yeah, I'd love to hear more about, you know, its evolution.
It was very organic. There was no master strategy, really, because it's been organic. I think that's what's made it successful. So my intent in 2019, when I was just setting up my consultancy, was to do the Counting the Music Industry research. And that had been on my mind to do, my to-do list, really, for years. It all came out of really my experience of overseeing the Ivor Novello Awards. And I knew from having attended so many and being closely involved in the production of it and the running of it for so many years, that there were very, very few women winning awards. And I did an analysis in 2016 of 60 years worth of data, and only 6% of awards had gone to women over that time period. And it hadn't really increased very much in recent times since 2010. Between 2010 and 2016, it had only gone up to 10%. So with, you know, lots of discussions with my board and the director of events, we really realized that it's a pipeline into these awards. And the people who submit to the Ivor Novello Awards are publishing companies, professional publishing companies. So it was really interesting to me, well, who were they signing? Who were they supporting? How many women were on their rosters? And I didn't have time to do that analysis while I was still chief execing. But once I had left, now's the time. So it took me a couple of months to identify the music publishing companies, have a look at the, you know, decide on my methodology. That sort of evolved into this big report, which was published at the end of 2019, caused quite a stir. I think the music industry thought it was further on than that. In my heart, I kind of knew that the publishing company statistic of only 14%, having worked with songwriters for so long, but that it would be somewhere around there. But the musician statistic really shocked me. I thought we would be further on than that. But out of that, I realized, oh, I have a list now embedded in this data of all of these women, these contemporary women in all genres of music, who are signed, you know, and therefore somebody has given them, you know, some sort of judgment of merit to be investing in them. So what if I pull out all of that data and make it public? Because then people can find them all in one place. So when people say, you know, when festival promoters or event promoters say, we don't have women in our lineup because there just aren't any, or we can't find them, or we've asked them all, you know, which these are things which have been said to me and I've seen printed in newspapers, when I hear that, I can just say, no, you haven't asked them all, because here were thousands over here, and you can just have a look and, you know, go book them. So I published that at the end of February 2020, and a BBC journalist called Mark Savage got hold of it as a story and wrote a news piece about it, and it just went crazy. And I was on the radio every day, and it all, you know, it was all fantastic. And then lockdown happened, which was a shock to the whole entire world, but it was definitely a big shock to music, and everything was cancelled. All of these festivals and events and everything was cancelled. I was in shock for a few weeks, and just sort of walking around, not quite knowing what I was going to do. And I had lost all of my work, all of my clients cancelled my work as well. So I decided to develop this F-List spreadsheet as a not-for-profit organisation. And I really put, you know, it was my lockdown project. In fact, I had all this spare time, had no work, no money, but all of this spare time. And I put out one tweet in June and said, I'm thinking about setting up a not-for-profit organisation supporting female musicians. Would anyone be interested in helping me? Thinking I'd have five or six responses, and I had like 120 women contact me saying, I'm in, how can I help? So then I was like, oh my goodness, this is fantastic. And, you know, we've sort of kept that momentum going. We've got a proper community interest company, a social enterprise with a board. I have 11 other women helping me. They are amazing. And I have about 70 other people. I'm saying people because a couple are men. You know, we've got to have help from men in the industry. So we've got a few great guys, but mainly women. And now I think there's about 5,300 entries on the F-List database. And every single day, a woman creates a new listing on the database, you know, and I listen to all of the music and I check them all out, and they are all fantastic. So yeah, it's just, you know, it just snowballed on. Go back to your point about the unpaid aspect. Yeah, this has been two solid years of work, well, three if you include my research the year before, and I haven't received a penny for it. You know, we've got funding to do special projects, but I've not had any funding yet. It is absolutely a labor of love. You know, I get thousands of people telling me how wonderful it is, but I still haven't quite figured out how to make it financially work. So that's something I am thinking of, but I just can't do anything but this work because I have to.
Yeah, I can totally see that you're totally driven by it. And it's so amazing that there's that many women now on something where, you know, less than 3 years ago, people were saying, well, you know, like you're saying, we've called all the women performers for festivals. You know, it's unbelievable. And I wonder, and you may not know the answer to this, but, you know, has that dial, that stat changed in the, because lockdown is a bit hard, hasn't it? We haven't been able to blow the gates off or the doors off as such. But have you seen a change in terms of, especially now that we're coming out of lockdown and things are opening up again? Has that list now started influencing potential programmers, publishers, etc.?
I believe so. Just from what I can observe, there are definitely certain genres which have more of a problem than others. That's true. But when I look at Glastonbury, for instance, you know, they're making such an effort, you know, and that did start to happen just before lockdown. Back in 2016, 17, Emily Evers, who runs Glastonbury, because her dad set it up, you know, she was appearing in national newspapers saying that she couldn't find the women, that she'd love to book more, but she couldn't find them. And then something happened, and all of a sudden, the percentage of women on the major stages started going up and up. She's doing really well and leading by example. I can't take any credit for that, but I do think me and all of the other women and music campaigners out there have put an awful lot of pressure on these big promoters, and they, you know, they are all talking about it, and it's, you know, it's headline news on the BBC, entertainment news and Music Week, and, you know, I just think there's so much pressure. They have to make more and more of an effort, and I would like to think I've been a small part in that change. I'm going to do another Counting the Music Industry update in 2024, because then it will have been 5 years And I'm very interested to see if there's been progress with the rosters, because the rosters of the labels and the publishing companies are the research and development equivalent. So the music industry calls it A&R, artist and repertoire. And that is, you know, that is the nourishing of future talent and the developing and the investing in musical talent for the rest of the industry. So, you know, what they choose or who they choose to invest in, you know, has an impact on who's appearing on festival stages, who's getting in the charts. I'm really interested, and I have no idea if it's gotten better or not. I really hope it does.
I think it's like 18 months away, right? 2024. So it's not even that far away, you know, so it'd be so curious to see, even in that short timeline, whether people are actually really, now that, you know, down we're moving on and things are opening up again, how that may change.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see about that as well. And people are using the F list to find and book musicians. You know, I know radio DJs who find new female talent for their shows and their playlists, festivals who are finding and booking artists through it, managers and labels who are finding unsigned talent, other musicians who want to find other female musicians to play with. So I know all of that is happening, and you know, I couldn't be happier. Every time I'm told about a particular success story like that, I just, yeah.
That's amazing. And I wonder, I mean, it's a bit of a personal question, but you know, you have put so much energy, focus, your time, your like emotional, mental investment. How do you manage, you know, giving so much of your energy, time, and kind of thinking to this? You know, how do you sustain your own levels of what you need to keep going?
I think I've always had a capacity to work hard, but when you're working hard on something you love, it's not work. It really isn't. I've done jobs, certainly when I was a student, that I hated, and you know, the clock every 5 minutes was like forever. It was torture, you know, working in shops, cleaning jobs, terrible experiences. So, you know, having gone through that, what I do now is an honor. So there's that. But also, I did move to Cornwall in 2019, and that, you know, the reason I made such a big change in my life is I'd had breast cancer at the end of 2017 through 2018, and I knew that I needed to move out of London and make some lifestyle changes. So moving down to Cornwall really does give me an opportunity to have much more chance to restore myself. And you know, look out the window now, and I'm on the edge of a small town, and looking, you know, looking at beautiful green fields anytime I want to, and that keeps me, you know, mentally, the levels of my stress are much lower just being able to look out the window and see that. And also, my, you know, my partner is pretty fantastic on insisting that I go for long hikes and go sailing and do these other things, you know, because I do have a tendency to be a workaholic, and he forces me to relax and do other things. So that's really helpful as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, nature's definitely a healer, right? It has that ability to switch. And yeah, I agree, looking out the window. And yeah, I'm sorry to hear about the breast cancer, but it sounds like it's given you another perspective as well in terms of where you are and what you're doing. So yeah, it's amazing. So you're also a trustee of Parents and Carers in the Performing Arts, PIPA, who I mentioned at the intro. So it'd be great to learn more about what they do and your role and how it connects all your experiences and journey.
Well, I came across them, yes, maybe 2017, something like that. I think they were just setting up. So when I was at Basker, we gave them a little bit of funding towards their very first research project. And really, it's something that particularly interests me because I became a single parent in 1999 and of twins. So I did most of my career development as an unsupported single parent of twins. Talk about giving yourself barriers even more than I had already, but throw that into the mix. So it was a great challenge day by day, just getting into work, to be honest. So I was very interested in an organization that was setting up that wanted to research and help come up with solutions, you know, particularly for organizations across theater, dance, and music. And I wanted to help contribute to that gathering of knowledge and helping others, because it was so darn difficult. the childcare situation in this country is just a disgrace, to be honest. So anything I could do, you know, in some small way to be able to feed into that fantastic organization. So yeah, they've gone from strength to strength. I have to say they've been amazing and inspirational, and it's been a privilege to be involved in them.
First of all, kudos to you having twins, point one, and having a career and single parent and managing all that. And that's amazing. But in terms of what Pippa do, kind of how are they connected to obviously people that are performers and also with children? Kind of how do they kind of do their outreach?
They work with organizations, so the employers in those industries, and help them become flexible employers. So, you know, job sharing and all sorts of flexi working. So they've become experts in that, helping theatre companies, dance companies and music companies be, you know, be better employers of those who either have parenting or caring responsibilities. I mean, I know numerous women in music who have chosen not to have children or can't have children and yet find themselves in their 50s caring for seriously ill parents, because again, you know, normally that responsibility falls primarily to women. So Pippa come up with great, great solutions with companies in helping them make that transition, because there's loads of things, practical things that they can do that they might not have considered.
That sounds wonderful. I feel like every sector, industry, company needs something like this, right? Because that touches every, especially in the creative industries where you're flexing and you're doing multiple roles and multiple things and multiple jobs. So yeah, that sounds incredible. I'm particularly interested in the work you do in campaigning and advocacy, because that definitely takes up a lot of your time. And it's also, in a positive way, it gives energy, but also takes energy, right? So how do you, what skills do you need to do those jobs?
I think the top one is communicating in many different ways. I've always liked being with people. I'm a people person, so I've always liked being part of the collective. I enjoy that. So I think one of the things I realized that I had a knack for was taking sometimes quite complicated information. So while I was at Basker, and now in fact we're really at the ISM, the Incorporated Society of Musicians, which actually last Saturday I became president of. So that was very nice.
Congratulations.
Thank you. That'll just be for one year. These sorts of organizations, they do a lot of campaigning on intellectual property and Brexit and, you know, things like that. Sometimes those topics can be very technical and complicated, and people just switch off. So I realized that I had a knack for taking very complicated information and being able to communicate it out in a way that most people could understand it. So, you know, writing articles and doing speeches and being able to just do presentations, being able to explain to members, to musicians, what these topics and different laws and so on, what impact in layman terms, what impact it would have on their lives. So I realized I had a knack for that. So I guess my PhD study, it's the same way as well. In fact, you know, I've had to learn the academic language. So that's been quite a learning curve over the past few years. But I'm taking that learning and passing it on to my network in language that they can understand.
You may have already answered this, because I think having twins and being a single parent and getting to work on time is very challenging. But I wonder, what is one of the biggest challenges you've faced in your career, and how did you overcome it?
Yes, that was definitely the number one thing in my life. You know, and my darkest moment, when I realized, you know, that the partner I had at the time wasn't going to be participating in that journey with me. That was a very dark moment. And yeah, it was a really tough start. And I, oh gosh, you know, just slowly had to piece together my life and adjust. And it took me over 2 years to get my foot back in the working world again, because of the complexities around childcare. So I, you know, finally did find a nursery that would take them on. And because the then Labour government at the time were implementing child tax credit system, working families tax credits, I was able to take a one-day-a-week job and have the childcare paid for at a state nursery, brilliant state nursery, Margaret Macmillan in Crouch End, and it's still going. It was absolutely wonderful, you know, and that enabled me to slowly get experience back in the world of working again. It was all sorts of things came into place, really. Having a financial tax system which would enable me to pay for the childcare, having a state nursery within walking distance and having places there, having very understanding employers, you know, because sometimes I couldn't get in, and this was before remote working and all sorts. So there was all sorts of key things just slotted into place over time. So it was a tough journey, really. And I think I spent a good 5 years working and actually being no better off than I had been on welfare benefits, because you know the money was going to childcare. But it was really essential for me and my mental health that I was back working, doing interesting things with lovely people, and you know, getting experience, so that the gap in my CV eventually started to not look so bad. Because you know, so hey, I had, you know, I've had two years at home in a 25 year working career now, so that's fine. You know, yeah, it took a while. It was a very, very slow process.
And it's kind of going back to talking about what you were mentioning before about education. It's having all those systems in place that enable that, you know, creativity, being able to survive, being able to have options. You know, all these systems do influence our opportunities and our potential. I know you've already talked about how passionate you are about things, but I'd love to hear from you, like what you love about what you do.
Gosh, I just think I'm so driven by social justice. You know, whether that's because of my Geordie roots, working class roots, which is very, you know, partly influenced by the labour movement. So, you know, my grandparents came from Jarrow, you know, part of the, you know, the miners strike and march, the Jarrow March, you know, that was sort of part of family folklore. And, you know, so I've really, yeah, always been driven by the idea of social justice and that we are all equal. That just seems to me a truth about humanity. So I just find it so rewarding being part of movements which further that aim. So that just gives me a deep sense of satisfaction that I'm doing my bit as an individual to make the world a better place. Even if I, you know, read the 10 on the news and go, oh no, you know, at least I'm, as an individual, I'm trying to do something about it, and that's what drives me.
It's so great, things like the F-list and all the research you're doing, and obviously your doctorate, you know, whilst change, we see it in fits and starts, right? But you know, even in the last, since 2016, and like you're saying, you're going to do another kind of piece of research and touch back on in 2024, change will have happened. Like that must be so satisfying to look at that and go, oh my gosh, something is happening, we can see it. I mean, of course we all want it to be way faster, but you know, it is sometimes just small steps are the big steps, right? And getting that momentum. So yeah, that's amazing. So look, it's been so great catching up with you and learning about all the incredible things you're doing, and yeah, a massive thank you to all this kind of unpaid work and your passion and your skills and your talents. And before I let you go, there's a few things I'd love to ask, like in addition to all the work, and you do many things, and you know, presidents and you know, running your own company and things like that, I'd love to know what's coming up for you, which I'm sure is going to be a long list.
Well, there's a lot going on in my new role as president of the ISM. So yes, over the next few weeks we've got some major announcements of work and projects, so that's all very exciting. That's in the pipeline. And then I've really, you know, I've got to do a lot of PhD work. I'm just about to start on my data capture with interviews. So I'm looking at women's careers in music. So I'm going to be spending the next 9 months interviewing 50 women across the music industry. So that's going to be a lot of work, but lots of fun as well. And more, yes, more stuff with the F list. We are fundraising. We are putting together some proper fundraising applications. So hopefully we can make that more sustainable. And yeah, I think that's about it really. And I just I want to keep working with lots of music organizations, helping them properly embed diversity and inclusion in their businesses.
So I guess lots of things going on. Before you leave, I was wondering if I could ask you two questions focused on if you could recommend a job in the creative industries that you know little about and that you'd like to know more about, then I could potentially get someone in that role on the podcast and break down what they're doing and how it works. And also, if you could suggest a woman or a person who identifies as non-binary that I could reach out to and potentially get on the podcast as well.
The first one, I really had to have a good think. I think the area that does interest me actually are women working in crafts. So I'm thinking quilters and that sort of area, because my understanding is it's female dominated, like very much female dominated. And therefore my presumption is it's probably not as financially rewarded as male dominated industry. So I wonder how on earth do they manage? How do they make a living? And then, yes, a woman with music who I greatly admire and I think would be really fabulous to talk to is a woman called Gabriella Delaccio. And she runs another music campaigning initiative called Donne. She has a sort of a similar directory, but it is for female composers. It's international and it's women through history as well. So whereas my directory is just focused on contemporary women and in the UK, her directory goes back to like the 12th century.
Oh my God, that sounds fabulous.
And she is an opera singer.
So interesting. No one's ever said quilter, someone in crafting. And I think that's such a fascinating, because it's also an historical creative outlet. So it's got kind of a legacy as well as women's work, but actually it's still ongoing and passed down normally, isn't it? It's normally in the family and that. So yeah, I'm really interested in that. It's a great suggestion. Thank you. And I'll definitely reach out to you after this to get those details, because I would love to catch up with who you suggested. Thank you so much for your time today, Vic. You, like I said, legendary, doesn't go as far to explain everything you're doing. So I really appreciate learning more about what you're doing and all the kind of amazing work that you're doing to change the industry.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure meeting you and finding out about your campaign work as well. It's fantastic to know that there are lots of us out there.
Thank you for listening. Please do subscribe to where you get your podcasts to make sure you're up to date with any new episode drops. And you can also follow us on Instagram, @greaterthan11. A huge thank you to Eden Richards, who creates all Greater Than 11% artwork and edits this beautiful podcast.